Blog Hi, this is Lisa.
Welcome to Lisa's Book Divas, where you'll get a sneak peek into the lives behind the authors, celebrities, and entertainers that you love to read about. Sit back, relax, and let Lisa and her guests entertain you. And now, your Book Divas host, Lisa L.C.
Good afternoon. This is Lisa, your host of Lisa's Book Divas. How are you today, Cheryl?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing wonderful. For those who are just tuning in, we have New York Times number one best-selling author Cheryl Woods on the line with us, and she's going to talk to us today about her new book, Mending Fences. Cheryl, can you tell us a little bit about your new book, how it's doing in sales, and what kind of feedback you've been getting on the new book?
Well, it's actually a reissue of a book that was out a number of years ago, way before my career started hitting the New York Times list. And as far as the sales, it's only been in stores for about a week, so I haven't seen actual sales numbers yet. I hope it's doing well. It came out in trade paperback this time. And it's a story that matters a lot to me because I think it's something that a lot of moms and daughters can perhaps read together, teenage daughters or college-age daughters, and it's a subject matter that is very prominent in the news right now, which is date rape and on campus and so on. And I think a lot of women don't always understand that things that happen to them are not always their fault.
Yeah, that's a good point. And do you know, I mean, maybe this is too personal, but was this based on personal experience of people you knew close to you, or maybe you can't say that, but where do you get your research for something like that, or what drove you to want to write a book like that, and how have things changed since the original release and today's, or this last week's release, I guess I should say?
Well, I think there has been a lot more attention in recent years to the subject of date rape and what constitutes date rape, because I think women are talking about it more, and it's being taken more seriously on campuses and college and that kind of thing. And, you know, in retrospect, I mean, I'm a lot older than college aged now, and, you know, there were times in my life that I was probably in circumstances that came pretty darn close to rising to that level, and I assumed that I put myself into those positions, and I think as an education process for myself, I learned over the years, I was very naive, as are a lot of kids in high school and college, and assume that, you know, when this happens between somebody they're seeing, somebody they know, that it is somehow their fault, and that they just took a misstep, and it's, you know, they find reasons to blame themselves as opposed to blaming the other person. And I think the world has changed in that regard, and I think women are more cognizant of the fact that they need to speak up, they can speak up. And even now, though, it's not always taken as a serious issue. And my original thought behind the book at the time that I wrote it actually had nothing to do so much with the date rape issue. I started out, a friend of mine, as often stories are inspired by things that people tell you, I had a friend who was telling me one day about the close neighbors they had and all the experiences they had with their neighbors. So I started out with a story about two friends who were backdoor neighbors, and their families were close and their kids were growing up together and all that kind of thing. And then the subject matter got more serious and more involved as I started developing the story. And I felt like it was something that needed to be written about. And as I said, I think that it's the kind of book, you know, I think mothers ought to read it, and if they feel it's appropriate, talk about it with their daughters so that they understand that, you know, these circumstances are not always their fault and that they have a right to say no. So it's a serious topic, and I deal with a lot of serious topics in my books over the years, but I try to do it in a balanced way. So, I mean, it doesn't take over. The whole book is not dark and depressing or anything like that. I try to deal with things realistically. And in terms of the research and so on that I did at the time, I was working before writing the book at a university medical center, and we had a rape treatment center. And so I had access to people who worked there and the kinds of cases they saw and the kind of women who came in for treatment under these conditions. So I did get a lot of background information from that.
Well, and I think today with the ability to search things online, I wonder how many, I mean, that wasn't available back, you know, years ago as easily as it is today. And maybe do you have some resources that you can point, you know, women to? Maybe I'm putting you too much on the spot, but if what would they search for online? You probably don't have links all.
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, there are lots of online resources. And I think in every community there are, certainly in large communities, there are rape treatment centers where people can anonymously, if they want to, call for information and seek counseling through various helplines that they have available in their own community. And then from that point, they can determine what steps they might want to take in terms of their own counseling or whether they feel like it's a situation that rises to the level of filing charges, anything like that. I think those resources are available pretty readily by looking either online or looking to see if there is a rape treatment center available at a nearby hospital or that kind of thing.
And just for the sake of moms out there that might be reading this and want to read that to their daughter or in a reading group or something, is there suggested reading? Is there certain things that you would suggest to moms on how to, you know, other than just reading the book, to bring certain points to their child's attention? I mean, there's every woman, I think every mom probably feels awkward. I know even with my own daughter, and she'll probably hate me for saying this, but, you know, I mean, just a few weeks ago, she's like, "Mom, we never had to talk about the birds and the bees." And so I must have not done a very good job on that. But, you know, so,
if she missed it, you may not have if she sort of missed the talk.
I might have thought I was doing it, but I probably was teaching her about the real birds and the bees outside because I'm an outdoor photographer for all I know. But anyways, I'm just wondering if there's like a guide or something for, you know, inept moms like me that they don't seem to get it right the first time of, because I do think this is an important topic. I'm glad to be able to do this interview because I do think there's probably a listener, maybe not today, but in the future that's going to pick up this podcast or download it and, you know, might find some strength out of that to pick up that phone and say, "Hey, I think this happened to me," or, "Hey, I think I'm in this situation," or, "Hey, I've got a friend," and might lead them to somewhere. So that's why
And I think whether it's the book or whether it's, as I said, so many of these situations have been on the news, and I think the key for any mom is to, you know, they talk all the time, the cliche about teachable moments, is when you see something like that on the news or when you happen to read, whether it's this book or some other book that touches on this kind of a topic, and you can say, you know, I was reading such and such a book, or I saw this story on the news. You know, have you or any of your friends been through anything like this? So you can do it in a sort of impartial way. Now, I'm not the expert in terms of psychological counseling on this kind of thing, but on the other hand, I think that anything that gives a mom an opening or a parent in whether it's about this topic or drinking or all those kinds of things. There are lots of opportunities that I think we often don't take advantage of, that to introduce it in a way that is non-confrontational, that is not putting a young person on the spot about what's going on in their life, but opens a door for them to tell about what's going on in their life. And, you know, it can help to build that bond and that trust when you do it. You know, it's the old thing in terms of the lines of communication, because when you start, you know, your kids just come in the door and you know they've had something to drink and they're underage and you go into a tirade, it's not going to be the same as if you do it dispassionately when they're stone cold sober and it has nothing to do with what they may have done, but the topic in general. Now, that's coming from a place, as I said, of not a professional counselor and, you know, just my gut instincts in terms of how you open lines of communication on any topic with anybody.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're doing a really good job, and you're hired. You are. You can come to my house anytime.
Oh, good. Well, sometimes that's what it takes. It's not me, but you know, if there are other adults in a child's life that you know they are more open with because there is not that parental, I mean, mothers and daughters, for as wonderful as my own mother was, and I always used to say when I was a kid that I raised my parents right because I felt like I could talk to them about a lot of things.
Oh,
and,
that's cool.
You know, and I had other friends who did not raise their parents as well as I did. And so the conversations didn't go, because my parents always said I could say anything. So I did. And,
oh,
you know, I bought into that. So then they were obligated to hear me out.
You know, I think that's a good point. I mean, really, I mean, that's probably what also has made you such a strong storyteller, because you were allowed to express and you were allowed to, I don't want to say like act out your emotions, but maybe that being able to say and express what you wanted and, like you say, raise your parents right, maybe that was actually your initial seeds inside you before you were even a writer. Or have you always been writing? Have you had the love of writing since you were a young child?
Actually, not so much. I'm still kind of stunned that this has been my career for all these many years, because when I was, I mean, I knew that I could write as a kid because I could write my way out of an essay test like crazy. But in terms of thinking that I, you know, that it was a passion or that it was what I wanted to do, I mean, I let my mom write my essays half the time. She loved to write. And, you know, I don't think they can take my fifth grade, you know, things, grades away from me now. But
no. But you've proven yourself already.
I hope they can. otherwise, I'm going to be in deep trouble. All the degrees will fall in the meantime after that, like little stair steps. But
I think we're all guilty of that a little bit. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, that's the joy of having parents who help you with your homework, right? That
exactly.
That they sometimes take it over and just do it. But I was not, even when I went to journalism school in college, but I went because I wanted to do graphic design. I didn't even intend to be a reporter, and yet suddenly there I was, and I did reporting for a number of years. And so the fact that I sort of decided at one point that to sit down and say, well, I read a lot of romances. I read a lot of Harlequins and Silhouettes and stuff way back when. And I thought, well, gee, you know, maybe I should try this. And the first time I sat in front of a blank piece of paper at that time and said, you know, where are my quotes? Where's my interviews? Where are my facts? And somebody pointed out to me that when you're writing fiction, you get to make it up. And It's still a shock to me that this is what I've done for the better part of my career.
Well, and I think that's wonderful. That it's funny how you just kind of end up on another path, and who knows, maybe in 10 years you'll be designing book covers or doing something. What did you want to do in graphic designs? What were you interested in doing?
Well,
at the time, I wanted
to do graphic design for newspapers, and I worked on the yearbook and the newspapers in college and in high school, and that's what I enjoyed doing, which the good part of this is that I can look at my cover designs and have a somewhat artistic sensibility about the balance or the type font and all that kind of thing, which I think, I know, probably has driven my publisher crazy over the years, because the art director and I are sometimes on different wavelengths about what works and what doesn't work. And I usually lose, but that's okay.
but at least I know how to explain what's
on my mind about the cover, and that something isn't balanced right or whatever.
Well, as long as the hair color matches and the eye color matches, then you're probably a little more settled. I know that there's been some books out there from other authors that, you know, the characters are totally different than what is perceived in a book.
That has happened.
Yeah.
Well, and that's one of my many excuses for why I don't do a lot of character descriptions in my books, which sometimes will drive readers insane. You know, they want a lot of physical description. And I've sort of operated under the theory that people like to put themselves into the character and visualize them in their own way. And if you give too many clues, they can't put themselves into the story as well. Now, that may just be the lazy person talking, but That's my
theory.
No,
I agree with that, actually. I actually prefer that, too. I mean, I love books with people on them. I love the books. Like your Mending Fences, I don't know how many people have even checked that out yet that or that'll be coming into this broadcast or hearing it later. But if you go to, is it Cheryl Woods, SHERYLWoods.com? Is that your website,
Correct.
Cheryl?
Yes.
And then, yeah, you've got a cover on there, I think I saw earlier.
Yeah, it is.
But Amazon or, yeah. It's just, I mean, it's a beautiful cover, and, you know, I like that you, well, I mean, for one, it's kind of a sensitive topic, you know, novel, too. So, I mean, I think your cover just works. I mean, I'm not a professional in that way either, but, you know, you've got the gal looking over the fence, and right away you're drawn into her, but you really don't know what she looks like, and you don't know, you know, too much about her. It makes you want to open that cover, and that's how I look at your cover on this particular one.
Oh,
so, and all your covers
yep.
have a soft, nice look. They're beautiful, beautiful. I wish I had your cover designer. She's, whoever it is, they do a good job, so.
Yeah,
but you probably have to fill
out,
like, a survey
do.
And... Yeah,
they,
I mean,
you know, I
do you get
that,
to pick your titles, too, or is that something that they change
for the
on
most,
you?
I mean, I certainly put in titles, and sometimes we have long discussions about the titles, and, you know, so it tends to be somewhat collaborative. I don't win every battle in anything. It's like,
well,
I
you sound like you're pretty easy to get along with.
That the control freak in me was going to be satisfied. Not so much.
Yeah. Well, and how many books are you writing a year? Are you doing, what, 3 or 4 a year, or how many are you doing?
Well, I've done in the past as many as 6 a year. I slowed down and more typically was doing 3 or 4. Now, I took most of the last year off. I decided that after 140-plus books that I needed to take off, not so much because I was worn out, but because I had neglected a lot of other things in my life to focus on that, and I also had my Chesapeake Shores series that was being developed for Hallmark at the time, and I was involved with that, so I said I'm going to take a year off and focus on some of these other things and then, you know, see where we go. So I'm just now kind of gearing up to go back into doing some things at a somewhat slower pace. I don't think I need to drive myself quite as crazy as I have.
Well, tell us a little bit about, you've got another book coming out, though, this fall, don't you? I'm pretty sure I just saw that.
Well, there's another reissue in the Sweet Magnolia series that is coming out in the fall. I think we're at Sweet Tea at Sunrise is coming out next month in trade paperback.
Okay.
And then there are some reissues next year, and then I'm working on a couple of new projects that may, if I can really get my act back into gear the way I'm supposed to, that may come out later in 2017, maybe. But I'm trying. I'm trying to meet that deadline for myself.
Well, tell us a little bit about your writing process. I mean, you are known for your family stories that are just full of punch and emotion, and, you know, I can tell just from the short time we've talked, you know, you're a very passionate, you know, lady, and I think a lot of your writing is coming from deep inside you. And how do you get that depth out onto the paper? What can you tell your listeners and other writers that are out there listening how to do what you do?
Well,
a little
I
bit?
Think, you know, in every story that I've written, even going back to the early ones where, you know, they were the shorter ones and I was kind of finding my way, and to sort of digress a little bit from that is I met someone once who was talking about writing the category romances, and she'd done a handful at that time, and I'd done quite a few more than that, and she was talking about how cookie cutter they were, and I just looked at her in kind of amazement because, yes, I thought, okay, yeah, you can do. They all have a boy. They all have a girl. The boy loses the girl, or the girl loses the boy, and then they get back together. From that standpoint, yes, but it would make, I'd be bored to tears after 140 books if that's all there was to the story. And so for me, yeah, I may start out with the boy and the girl, and even, you know, now in the bigger, more complex books that I've done in recent years, it goes well beyond that to the family dynamics or to the, you know, I'll start out maybe with, in the Sweet Magnolias, I tend to deal with a few more issues, or in my standalones, I deal with even more serious issues, the few I've done of those, and find a way to weave that into the story. And that those layers appeal to me. But on the other hand, I also like to write, I think personalities, whether it's the voice that you decide you're going to use as a writer or the voice that comes naturally as a writer. And for me, the voice that comes naturally has a lot of humor to it. And mm-hmm. the first couple of times I wrote a book with a very serious theme to it, I did one that had a suicide theme because that had touched my life with a couple of friends, very sadly. And so when that happened, I really wanted to deal with the topic and all of the emotions that go with that topic. But I also did not want to be so mired down. And I can recall talking to my editor at that time and saying, you know, you got to get me out of this dark hole. How am I going to get out of this dark hole? Because I don't want to go mm-hmm. down there so deep that nobody wants to read the book and I can't stand to finish it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she really helped me find ways to bring humor in that, and I think it's true in Mending Fences to some degree too, in a way that is natural to the people in the story, but doesn't take away from the seriousness of the topic, because I think that's the way most of us live our lives. We have to find the humor in the most dire situations to get through them. And
yeah,
so that's what I really have tried to put into these books when I do go serious, so to speak. And then on the other hand, with Chesapeake Shores, although there's certainly serious moments and serious topics in there, they're much lighter in general in that series. You know, and I can sort of take a deep breath and relax and hopefully the characters will have a smile on their face or I'll have a smile on my face, you know, if my story brings me to tears every time I read it, then I have a hunch that I've gotten it right.
I'm laughing because I know that feeling. I know what you're saying. I know exactly what you're saying. If you can't entertain yourself, why are you even writing it? I mean, that's how I look at it.
Right. Well, and, you know, when I wrote, because I wrote a number of mysteries, and that was, fortunately, I was so lucky because in the half or the dozen or more that I wrote, I worked with editors who allowed me to give them as my proposal and they were the cozy mysteries. They were not terrible. They were never graphic, terrible things. I was much more interested in the solution of who did it than in the graphic violence or whatever that had happened. But when I did those, I was able to write the opening scene that set up the story, and that was enough for them to say yes or no to the story, as opposed to writing a detailed synopsis where I already knew where the book was going, because the best part of writing that was discovering, you know, putting myself into the character and writing the story, discovering things as I went, like I would have as a journalist, for instance, and picking up all these threads. And then every now and then, one of my favorite things from that time was I had, in one particular instance, told my editor who I thought was the culprit. And all the way through the book, I thought that's who the culprit was. And I got to the last chapter, and all these people were gathered together for this big reveal, and it turned out he wasn't the one. And that was so much fun for me. Because, I mean, I did have to go back to the beginning of the book and make sure he was in town when the murder happened. You know, mm-hmm. you can't just pull it out of thin air. But on the other hand, as a writer, how much fun is that to just be surprised? And you know, and I figure if I was, the readers were really going to be surprised. But you couldn't do it in a way that didn't make sense. You had to play fair and make sure that, you know, you went back and did a thorough check and all that kind of thing to make sure it would work. But and to some degree, I can't do that with my other books. They really want to have a clue at least of what the beginning, the middle, and the end might be.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you have, do you prefer working on standalone books, or do you find more satisfaction out of, like, writing in a series?
I think I love the series the best because, for the same reasons that readers gravitate to series, that you're going back to people that you've come to know, you're discovering new layers about them, at least the way that I write series, and not every author who does series does it exactly the same way. You know, the characters who were the primary characters in earlier books are always popping in and out in my later books. It's not just a sequential theme of, okay, yes, we're back in this town. So you're always, those characters are always continuing to grow. They may not be the primary story anymore, but they're growing, they're changing, and so I'm always discovering new layers about them. And I think, as all of us have discovered, we don't live in the same world that our parents or grandparents lived in, where everybody lived in the neighborhood. I mean, I was very fortunate when I was very young, because as a little kid, everybody in my mom's side of the family, just about, lived in the same apartment complex. Now, you're not going to find that a lot anymore. I mean, they're not even in the same town necessarily anymore, because, you know, somebody's gone to college and then they settle somewhere else, and, you know, you get together for holidays occasionally and you can lose touch to some degree. And yet I think we all kind of have longed for those connections that we used to have. And when I, and when you write a series, whether it's a mystery series where, again, the main characters are people that you've come to know because you love that series, or the kind of series like Chesapeake Shores or The Sweet Magnolias or those that Robin Carr writes or Susan Mallory or any of the other people who write those kind of series, you feel that connectedness with every book. Going in, you're very comfortable with who it is. And I see it. I mean, one of my favorite authors in the mystery field is a Canadian author, Louise Penny, who's become, you know, a New York Times best-selling author. I've never met her. She lives up in Canada, and she writes about a town, just a small town, the kind I like, just outside of Montreal. And every time I go back to that book, I'm reintroduced to that same cast of characters, and it's like there's a comfort in that and kind of knowing, and yet the story itself can be very, very different. But it's another layer to those people I know.
Yeah, and that's what makes you such an enjoyable writer yourself, is because, I mean, like you just said, I mean, you're picking that up out of other people, and I think you're pulling some of that in maybe, and that's helping you share. You're just like taking that energy and like recreating it into your own little worlds here, and I so appreciate your writing. I'm very glad you didn't take the journalist path for too much longer, and that you got into the serious writing that you're in. And I mean, I know we're running close on the end of time here. If there's anything you'd like to say, is there anything you'd like to say to the listeners about your book or your series or anything that you'd like to tell them?
I hope that at least some of them have had a chance to see how Chesapeake Shores adapted for television. Our season finale is on Sunday night, and one of the things that people, again, when you become very involved in a book series and then it's translated for television, there are people who like are so jarred by the changes. And way back when, I was a television critic, and I've been much more pragmatic than some of my readers are about why certain changes have needed to be made. And again, I look at it as an opportunity to take the characters I created and add layers to them that perhaps I didn't imagine, and to create some surprises so that people who've read the books can enjoy that too. So for me, it's come full circle, because, you know, I spent 10 years as a television critic when I wasn't still in journalism. And so for me, it's been great fun, and I hope some of the readers have been able to go over and try that aspect of my life as well.
Well, Cheryl, I've really enjoyed this half hour. I could talk to you for another 10 hours probably, but then that's why I'm the host and I drive everybody crazy, because I actually cut my show back. I used to do an hour show because I had no problem filling that either. So
anyway. You get a couple of writers together who spend a lot of time alone, and you get them to talking. It can go.
That's true. That's my excuse.
Yep. Yes.
Oh, that's funny. Well, we've been talking with number one New York Times best-selling author Cheryl Woods, and about her book Mending Fences and her career. Check her out at CherylWoods.com, SHERRYL.com. I'm sorry, did I do that right? SHERRYL Woods. Yeah, WOODS.com. And Cheryl, thank you so very much for coming on the show today, and we look forward to possibly getting to have you back on a future show, and you just, well, that was kind of quick.
Thanks,
there.
Lisa.
Thank you so much, and we'll come back on the air in a couple months or next year sometime, would you?
Great, I sure would. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks,
okay.
Cheryl. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
You've been listening to Book Divas with Lisa Elsie. If you're an author or entertainer and you'd like to be considered for an upcoming broadcast, log on to Lisa's Book Divas website at www.bookdivas.com for more information. That's BOOKDIVAS.com. Lisa will be back next week to continue this Book Divas journey.